They must accept us as Rohingya and give us our dignity back. That's all we ask from the Myanmar government. If they give us that, we will return on our own.
Resistance remains for Myanmar repatriation. It's Monday, August 26th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're glad to have you with us. You can also follow us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Australia to help patrol a key shipping lane. Asia burns more coal as a top producer collapses. Tough to tackle Trump. New virtual reality experiences and a century of NFL. It's all on today's VOA Asia. 2 years ago, Myanmar's army drew international condemnation for driving more than 750,000 Muslim Rohingya into neighboring Bangladesh. This past week, the Myanmar and Bangladesh governments announced the beginning of a voluntary repatriation plan for many of those. However, not a single person has volunteered to go back. Steve Sanford spoke with refugees and rights workers about the prospect of returning home amid security and rights concerns.
Tensions were running high in the Rohingya camps as a plan to begin refugee repatriation was originally set to start. Aid groups have called for returnees to be granted full citizenship and the rights that come with it. But critics say little has changed since the crisis started.
Rohingya that return will be confined to transit centers for a number of days, and they'll be forced to take NVC cards, national verification cards. National verification cards do not give the Rohingya the right to self-identify as Rohingya, and they're based off a discriminatory law, the 1982 citizenship law.
The Refugee Relief and Repatriation Commission reports that a total of 295 families have been surveyed so far, but no one was willing to return to Myanmar. The results were no surprise for most in the crowd, and one Rohingya father was still unclear why he was on the initial list of 3,450 potential returnees surveyed.
In Myanmar, my brother and relatives have been jailed. The Burmese must release them first before we return. They must accept us as Rohingya and give us our dignity back. That's all we ask from the Myanmar government. If they give us that, we will return on our own. They don't need to come pick us up.
It was a sentiment shared by many refugees, including Seidel Mustafa.
My Rohingya brothers are living in Myanmar refugee camp, IDB camp. They have not got right. Well, it's not. So how can they are repatriation me from Bangladesh? If they are willing to repatriation us, at first they need to clear about IDB camp.
A UN fact-finding mission has concluded that the Myanmar military intended to perpetrate genocide on the Rohingya when it drove hundreds of thousands of them from the country. And the idea of refugees lining up to return home remains a non-starter. Steve Sanford for VOA News in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh.
In Hong Kong, police drew their guns, fired tear gas, and for the first time, water cannons at anti-government protesters in the 12th weekend of demonstrations. Thousands of protesters took to the streets, some of them throwing bricks at police, attacking them with sticks and rods, and spraying detergent on streets to make it slippery for police. Some of the demonstrators, many in masks and wearing black, broke store windows and hurled tear gas canisters back at police. The vast majority of protesters marched peacefully, but police at times fired bursts of tear gas at wildcat demonstrators who broke away from the largest groups. The protests in the major Asian finance center are the biggest threat to peace there since Britain handed over control of Hong Kong to China in 1997. The protesters say they are demonstrating against what they see as an erosion of rights under the One Country, Two Systems arrangement under which Beijing assumed control of the territory. Some demonstrators say they have resorted to violent tactics because the government has not responded to their demands. The weeks-long demonstrations in Hong Kong began with calls to stop an extradition bill, which has now been scrapped, but have now expanded to include demands for full democracy. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit our website at voanews.com. President Trump says he wishes he had boosted China tariffs higher. U.S.-Japan trade deal coming in September, according to Trump. South Korea begins drills near disputed islands. Violence erupts on 12th weekend of Hong Kong protests. Rohingya refugees protest exodus, demand rights in Myanmar. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more with videos and photos when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia and our website, voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Australia will send a warship and surveillance aircraft to the Persian Gulf to join an international effort to combat Iran's actions in the Strait of Hormuz, one of the world's most important shipping lanes. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia has for several weeks been considering joining the US-led military effort, which also includes Britain and Bahrain. Tensions in the region increased after United Kingdom forces helped authorities in Gibraltar seize an Iranian tanker, believing it was carrying oil to Syria in breach of European Union sanctions. Iran retaliated by impounding a British ship in the Persian Gulf. Earlier this month, US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, on a visit to Sydney, urged Australia to join efforts to counter Iran's unprovoked attacks on international shipping in the Strait of Hormuz. The government in Canberra has decided to send a warship, surveillance aircraft, and military personnel to join the US-led mission. The Navy frigate is scheduled to arrive in January. Officials believe any disruption to the flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz is a potential threat to the Australian economy. Up to 30% of Australia's imports of refined oil is transported through the key shipping route that connects the Persian Gulf with the Arabian Sea. Prime Minister Scott Morrison says it's vital oil tankers move freely through the narrow waterway.
Our decision is based on our national interest. And solely on our national interests. We have considered Australia's interests in this matter, our commitment to issues such as freedom of navigation, shipping lanes. I went through the precise details of how much of our own oil supplies come through this pathway. And so there is a clear interest here.
Prime Minister Morrison has travelled to France for the G7 meeting, where Australia's involvement in the Strait of Hormuz would be discussed with world leaders. Australia has insisted its role is to de-escalate rising tensions in the region. In Canberra, the opposition Labour Party has supported the military deployment, stating it was an appropriate response. But many of the United States' allies in Europe, including Germany, have been reluctant to join the military effort for fear of provoking open conflict with Iran. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, President Donald Trump is threatening to use the emergency authority granted by a powerful but obscure federal law to make good on his tweeted order to U.S. businesses to cut ties in China amid a spiraling trade war between the two nations. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's that time again. We're starting a new week. We're glad you're with us on VOA Asia. Coal has powered progress since the Industrial Revolution, and while coal-fired power is on the rise in Asia, it's declining in the United States and much of Europe as cheaper alternatives and climate concerns push it out of the market. The western state of Wyoming is this nation's leading coal producer. But now coal's troubles have arrived in that energy-rich state, as VOA Steve Barragona investigates.
The colossal mines of Wyoming's Powder River Basin ship some of the cheapest coal in the country to power plants from Georgia to Oregon. As coal-fired power has lost ground to natural gas and renewables, companies with mines here still felt secure, says University of Wyoming economist Robert Godby.
Those companies were seen to have jewels in their balance sheets because the Powder River Basin was so profitable. But that's changed in a few short years.
This year, two Wyoming coal companies went bankrupt.
The gates went down, they pulled everybody off. And that is a really sobering moment because it is the thing they said would never happen, and it happened.
Melissa Peterson-Worden worked for Black Jewel, the second of the two failed companies. Black Jewel's messy bankruptcy has disrupted her life and the lives of about 600 others.
Oh, we're struggling. We're struggling. We're holding on. Our big one is the house payment. Hi, girls.
Former Black Jewel miner Rory Wallet says until now, working in the mines has been a good job with good pay and benefits.
It's a wonderful way to make a living, a decent, livable living. I've got four kids, so it's a great way to keep them insured, keep food on the table, keep a good home over their head.
Coal has built the city as you see it, I feel, with the royalties and property tax and sales tax.
Louise Carter King is mayor of Gillette, Wyoming, home to two Black Jewel mines and several others. She says the city has to find new industries, and she has high hopes for the new integrated test center nearby. Next year, competitors from the Carbon X Prize will plug in to the coal-fired power plant's exhaust to find ways to capture and make products from the plant's carbon dioxide.
Even though there's just one winner for the $10 million prize, the other four won't be bad, you know, and so we're hoping some of the, you know, one of those industries or more could stay here.
Many scientists consider carbon capture essential to fighting climate change, but it's years off at best. In the meantime, Rory Wallet says recent events have shaken his faith in coal, but not by much.
I'd lie if I said it didn't. I plan on hanging on. If I don't get a coal job immediately, I'll keep looking in the basin. They're always available. It really is part of family and part of life. It's something I love doing.
But there's a growing sense in Gillette that coal will not be here forever.
That is the big question. What's next? And pardon the pun, Gillette needs to dig deep to figure out what next is. The United States is saying, what do you have for us now? And we have to come up with a better answer than, if you don't like coal, don't turn your lights on. We can't be those people anymore.
It's an uncertain future for a city and an industry in transition. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Gillette, Wyoming.
Coming up, struggling Trump opponents. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia. President Donald Trump says the United States and Japan have reached an agreement on a trade deal in principle that will be signed in September during the UN General Assembly. Trump spoke to reporters as he met with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on the sidelines of the G7 summit in France. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Democratic presidential contender Julian Castro got some good news this past week. Castro became the 10th Democrat to qualify to take part in next month's Democratic presidential debate in Houston, Texas. But several other Democrats likely will not make the cut for that debate, hampering their chances of building support in the crowded and at times chaotic primary battle. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
For Julian Castro, a whirlwind of campaigning has paid off as he has claimed a spot in the third round of Democratic debates next month.
And I believe that we can get stronger and stronger. We still have 5 months to go until the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary. That by that time, we work hard, I can be a front runner.
We'll get you the history.
But it's a different story for New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, who is among those scrambling to qualify for the next debate.
It's a tough goal for us. We've been working at it. And what I'm looking at is if we can't get into the September debate, to get into October.
The large Democratic field has slowly begun to shrink with the exit of Washington Governor Jay Inslee and former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, who's now running for the Senate.
But this is no time to walk away from the table. I know changing Washington is hard, but I want to give it a shot.
Other Democrats are still hanging in the race despite low poll numbers, including New Jersey Senator Cory Booker.
and stand together and work together and love together and overcome his darkness with our light. This is the call of our country, and it is time for the United States of America to rise again. Thank you.
Booker will be in the next debate, as will Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar.
I plan to keep taking it to Donald Trump. I plan to keep making the case for an optimistic economic agenda for this country.
But for those who miss qualifying for the next debate, the campaign road only gets harder, says Susan Page.
We have our third set of debates coming up in early September. It's a little harder to qualify for those debates. We think those numbers will come down. And once a candidate doesn't make the debates, it gets harder for him or her to raise money to get supporters to stay in.
But with over 20 presidential contenders, the next few months will be a make-or-break time for several of the low-performing candidates, says analyst Daryl West.
I see a number of candidates probably going to be dropping out over the next 1 or 2 months. Certainly the ones that do not qualify for the upcoming September debates, they're going to see their money dry up and they're going to lose the media platform. And so their candidacies will basically be over.
Former Vice President Joe Biden continues to lead the Democratic field, followed by Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, California Senator Kamala Harris, and South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. All of them will be on the debate stage next month. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
This news from VOA Asia. Australia will send a warship and surveillance aircraft to the Persian Gulf to join an international effort to combat Iran's actions in the Strait of Hormuz. It's one of the most important shipping lanes in the world. Australia has for several weeks been considering joining the U.S.-led military effort. Lead your effort for the latest news with a visit to VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, imagine listening to a violin concert in one of New York City's majestic cathedrals or in the National Arboretum surrounded by blooming magnolias. Well, now anyone can experience this exquisite scene with the use of VR glasses. A team of researchers from the University of Maryland at College Park came up with new immersive technologies that can be viewed from anywhere in the world. We hear more from Nastasia Yeoman.
New technology by researchers at the University of Maryland at College Park allows anyone with a pair of virtual reality glasses to attend a classical music concert in all kinds of unique settings. The tech combines two recordings, one of a musician playing and the other of a 360-degree picture setting. Viewers can see all around them and even hear the sounds change as they turn their heads.
Right now, attending of opera is limited based on where the opera performance is happening, how much it costs, and when you have the time to attend it. So one of the big challenges that I wanted to address in this was to see if we could bring opera, a very intimate, detailed, inspiring experience like the opera, to the masses.
Mixing classical music and technology may not seem a natural fit, but for musicians like Associate Professor Irina Murushanu, it opens up a whole new world.
The concept of performing outside in an outdoors place, such as the Arboretum, which was one of the places where we took the Piazzolla Tango, would have been impossible because the sound is not really carried, you know, outdoors. But I could see myself playing amongst beautiful flowers because, again, I was a hologram and we had previously recorded the music in a concert room.
To make it work, researchers had to film Murushanu performing in a special studio for a great sound. Then they went to the National Arboretum and the New York City Cathedral and recorded the interior with a 360-degree camera.
The most difficult part of this project was to match our performer with the background because they're being recorded from two different locations, and how we can match the depth and also the lighting of our performer and the environment is a very important and challenging task for us.
Researchers think this is just the start. The University of Maryland is collaborating with Washington, D.C.'s museum to tell all kinds of stories. In one, people play the role of a person trying to escape communist East Germany during the Cold War.
It is one thing to have the guard towers and look at them. It's quite another to experience, put yourself in the shoes of somebody running to freedom with the guard dogs chasing them, with the crunch of the gravel beneath their feet, with the guards at the guard towers shining lights on you and shooting at you.
Similar projects will allow medical students to practice complex surgeries and let future policemen act in virtual dangerous situations they might face on duty. Scientists believe the possibilities are limited only by our imagination. Nastasia Omen for VOA News, College Park, Maryland.
It's hard to believe, but we have another National Football League season upon us. The American Football's Professional League next week will open its 100th season with a game featuring its oldest rivalry, the Chicago Bears versus the Green Bay Packers, the two teams that first faced off in 1921. The Green Bay Packers, based in a city of just more than 100,000 in the state of Wisconsin, holds a number of other distinctions. Among them, it's the smallest market for any major U.S. sports franchise, and the Packers are publicly owned. VOA's Jeff Custer steps from the sidelines to the field in Green Bay.
Some 4,000 people streamed into Green Bay's Lambeau Field one morning in mid-July, weeks before any scheduled game. These were not just any fans, but stockholders in the publicly held not-for-profit Green Bay Packer franchise. In effect, they're the team's owners. They are here for their annual meeting.
This is great that the people of Wisconsin and everywhere own a little chunk of them. I even own a chunk of dirt.
At the last sale, a share of Packer stock cost $250. It allows each holder to attend the annual meeting and vote for members of the team's board of directors. But otherwise, the stock is effectively a donation. It pays no dividends, gains no value, and cannot be traded. Team President Mark Murphy says the Packers' publicly owned status has kept them alive.
The team wouldn't still be in Green Bay were it not for this ownership structure, and we've had five stock sales over the history of the organization, and the first three were really meant to save the team and to make sure the team stays here.
Formed in 1919, the team was named after a local meatpacking company. It joined what would become the NFL in 1921, but by 1922, it was apparent the Packers would have to sell stock to survive. But the team's early survival was also helped by what Packer historian Cliff Crystal calls Green Bay's dirty little secret.
This town never shut down for Prohibition.
I like drinking and carrying on all night long.
Prohibition, which lasted from 1920 to 1933, outlawed the sale and consumption of alcohol in the United States. But Green Bay chose to ignore the law, making the small city a popular place for teams to come and spend money.
But I'm only good at being bad.
They didn't have enough people to support a team. They didn't have a lot of money. And to be truthful, their crowds weren't that big. But visiting teams loved coming here, and they would come in early, they'd stay late.
Following Prohibition, the Packers survived and thrived because they won a total of 13 championships, the most of any NFL franchise. But as Murphy points out, stock sales for the publicly held franchise did get the Packers through some tough times.
My predecessor, Bob Harlan, often said it's the greatest story in all professional sports, that the small market team just has overcome odds and had all kinds of success.
NFL rules prevent other teams from copying the Green Bay model, making the small-town Packers unique. And Murphy says that's a good thing. Jeff Custer, VOA News, Green Bay, Wisconsin.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on iTunes and SoundCloud. You'll find us online at voanews.com. And, of course, VOA Asia Facebook. You'll find us on the radio. Radioactive at Temasek Polytechnic in Singapore carries our program. If you happen to be there, tune in. We thank everyone who has. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Zainab Abdel-Rahman, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Keith Lane. We also like to thank Michelle Liu for getting our program onto Facebook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.